Welcome back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of our podcast, and I want to thank all our listeners that join us worldwide to listen to the words of wisdom from our authors. And this morning on the line, I have Lawrence Kotlikoff joining me. He's a professor of economics at Boston University. Good day to you, Larry.
Hey, good day to you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we appreciate having you on, and oftentimes when I get these books, it's kind of an interesting a trail that it takes to actually find the authors and do the interviews. And in your particular case, I happen to be in a presentation that David Honeycutt was doing, who is the founder, one of the founders of Wellcoa. And he was referencing your book, The Coming Generational Storm, regarding the effects it's going to have on healthcare overall. And I found it quite interesting, and I want to let my listeners know that this topic in particular has some far-reaching effects for not only our country and worldwide, but also us as individuals. And it kind of compelled me to want to get in touch with you, Larry, and talk about this further. So I'm going to let our listening audience know about you. Larry is a William Fairfield Warren Professor at Boston University, a professor of economics at Boston University, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a fellow of the Econometric Society, research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and the president of Economic Security Planning, Inc., a company specializing in financial planning software. Columnist for Bloomberg, a columnist for Forbes, and a blogger for The Economist. Larry received his BA in economics from the University of Pennsylvania in 73 and his PhD in economics from Harvard in 77. He's the author of 14 books and hundreds of professional journal articles. His most recent book, which we'll be doing an interview on later, is Jimmy Stewart is Dead. And he also has been written a book called Spend Till the End, co-authored with Scott Burns, Simon & Schuster, The Healthcare Fix, and the one we're going to be speaking about today called The Coming Generational Storm. Larry, it is fascinating, and you mentioned in the book that in 2030, the numbers of walkers will outnumber the numbers of strollers. And this was a statistic that I don't think at the time when David Kotlikoff was doing the speech and that I was at, I really realized myself, what are the implications to statistics like this and the economics to us as individuals in a country? What are the overall implications of that upcoming in 2030?
Well, in 2030, we're going to have about 120% more old people and only about 23% more people of working age. So, and we've been running a massive Ponzi scheme since the early 50s, associated with expanding Social Security. Eisenhower doubled the program in his 8 years, and Nixon double indexed it. And then we had Medicare come in to play, and under Reagan, Medicare and Medicaid benefits expanded dramatically. And then we've had President Bush, interesting, a lot of Republicans, he introduced the Medicare Part D program, which is health insurance for prescription drugs for the elderly. So we've had actually a lot of Republican administrations as well as Democratic administrations engaged in running what is a systematic Ponzi scheme. So let me be clear to your listeners that I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, and I think these programs, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, have done enormous good, but they've been run in a way that they've been forcing younger people to pay the bills for them. So it's one thing for each generation to make sure that it takes care of itself and make sure that nobody who needs health care is left without. It's another to ask their kids and grandkids to pay those bills. And we've been accumulating all these liabilities, and they're going to be much larger because of the demographics. So it's the interaction of very high benefit levels. So promises of very high benefit levels to 78 million baby boomers that we're facing, combined with the fact that there are 78 million baby boomers and they're poised to retire. So if you look out to 2030, the typical baby boomer is going to be receiving $40,000 in from the federal government in on average in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. And that's going to be about 85% of per capita GDP at the time. Today's number, and these are in today's dollars, so it's $40,000 in today's dollars. So that's going to be about a $3 trillion bill to the baby boomers just for those three programs. And that's just an example of an illustration of the magnitude of the problem we're facing. We have these huge bills every year coming due in the future. And relatively speaking, not that many young people to help pay those bills. So we're kind of at the end of this chain letter, this Ponzi scheme, where there's nobody left to buy the letter. And the baby boomers have paid a huge price for buying the letter that they bought, helping the older generation that's now retired. And they want to, in effect, expropriate the next set of young people, their kids, and there aren't that many for them to go after.
Well, like all Ponzi schemes, Larry, they kind of come to an end. You know, there's always a there's been a lot of them out there that we've all known about where people have been bilked out of a lot of money. But you speak about this generational accounting, and you say unless as adults we make up this very large sacrifice, or we make a very large sacrifice, quickly the children will be forced. Now, you're saying that the taxes will be two times what we basically face today. So are you advocating or saying that, let's say I'm 56 years old and I have a 29-year-old son, that in his generation, and these Gen Xers and Millennium Group, that they'll be faced with in excess of two times in taxes just to make up these current debts?
In tax rates, and it might even be higher than that, the problem is that we've been running this Ponzi scheme in ways that don't show up on the government's books. So we've been accumulating these unofficial liabilities to pay Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, and also defense spending, which is very, you know, the country's spending more than the next 15 countries combined each year in defense, and we're spending a lot of money on two wars that we're obviously not winning and need to end. If we can't really win them, we need to stop sacrificing our young people. And so we have lots of expenses, and these are liabilities that aren't on our books. So we've been doing Enron-type accounting. Indeed, I think Enron learned how to do its accounting from Uncle Sam. So that the vast majority of our liabilities that show up in the generational accounting, because that doesn't leave anything out of the picture, are unofficial implicit liabilities. But it's likely that we would sooner default on our official debt than we would cut Social Security benefits for current retirees or even near-term retirees. So these liabilities that are unofficial in an economic sense are more real than the ones that are official, but they're not counted because of the way we use language. We use words to use some words to describe government receipts, and we use other words to describe other receipts. And the choice of those words are arbitrary, but they lead to different amounts of the total liabilities being reported as official versus unofficial. So that's one of the lessons that the coming generation storm is trying to teach the reader, namely the fundamental analysis of our fiscal policy has no economic truth to it, in the sense that we're focused primarily on official debt, and those official numbers are, economically speaking, content-free.
But so you're saying there's a flaw in the current way in which we're recording it as a government.
Yeah.
And it's a major
accounting,
flaw.
Yeah. And the generation, it's a very major flaw. We've got an emperor's new clothes situation. We're looking at the wrong numbers. We have a chapter in that book called Driving in Los Angeles with a Map of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're doing. We're focused on the debt, the deficit, and the real picture are these. The real story is that we have these massive Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other liabilities, defense spending liabilities, out over time. And when you put those on the same footing as the official debt, and then you also take into account the assets, not just
Right.
You know, the assets here are the government's tax revenues that are projected to come in. When you put everything together and you form what's called a present value, the value in the present of all this, all these future bills plus all the future money to pay them, you find out that the government is really short about $200 trillion. That's what our fiscal gap currently amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
And that would, and to cover that, to close that fiscal gap, we would have to immediately and permanently double all federal tax rates from now till the end of time. And the numbers I'm citing here for the current fiscal gap of $200 trillion are coming right out of the Congressional Budget Office's June 25th, 2010 alternative fiscal scenario forecast. So
you're saying all of these effects in the society, the ones that aren't being accounted for, have an extremely long tail. And you mention in the book that the real danger in going critical is that the country gets stuck in what economists call this bad steady state. Aren't we really there now, and what are the characteristics of what you would consider a bad steady state?
Well, I would say a bad steady state is where you have each generation that shows up to go to work and to have a good life is facing a set of old people with huge demands on their earnings, and the government is has set the tax rates to be quite high, and it gets to the point where they can't necessarily raise them even any further. People might leave the country or stop working, and then they start printing money to try and pay these bills, and then you end up with inflation, if not hyperinflation. But you've kind of condemned the country to have each generation face huge bills because they always have to pay off the chain letter that they're forced to buy. Now, there's only so much expropriation one can do of younger people. They only have 100% of their wages to hand over to the elderly. So there's a limit to this, but you can kind of get close to that limit and then just sit there for forever, where you've basically destroyed the American dream, where you've taken the incentive to work hard and to make more money away because you've got very high marginal tax rates. And we have so many different programs that are affecting the marginal taxation of people. We have transfer programs. If you earn too much money, you lose your Medicaid. If you earn too much money now, you'll lose your earned income tax credit. If you earn too much money, you're going to lose your subsidy for that new health exchange that's just been introduced. If you earn too much money, you lose food stamps. You have all these implicit taxes, and then you've got the explicit FICA tax, which has just been raised for people that are earning more than $250,000 if they're married. But the thresholds are not indexed to inflation, so over time, all our kids are going to be facing another 0.9, basically giving up another 1% of their salary to the government as Medicare payroll taxes. There's another the federal income tax has got taxes within taxes. It's got the alternative minimum tax, which you know, it's impossible really for anybody.
What is that FICA tax today? Just out of curiosity, what are people paying Social Security tax?
Here again, we report things in ways that lie to the public about what's going on. We call half of the tax the employer tax, as if the employer is actually paying it, but it's really coming out of our own pockets because the employer is not paying our taxes out of the goodness of his heart. We're paying it through getting lower wages. So he sends in half the total tax bill, which is 7.15%, and we pay 7.15%, and together it's 15.3%. So imagine that going up. Imagine your FICA payments going up double today, and staying there forever, and not just yours, but your employer's. So your salary would fall by 15%. And imagine your federal income tax rates going up by a factor of two. And imagine imagine the corporate tax having to double. That's the kind of solution that we need right now in order to get that fiscal gap to zero, because these future bills are so big. So we really can't deal with this problem by raising taxes. We have to cut the spending. And the book has some solutions for how to get control of the spending, about how to fix Social Security, how to fix the healthcare system, how to fix the I've written also about how to fix the tax system and the financial system. And some of these solutions are finally being discussed. If you look at the proposal that Paul Ryan and Alice Rivlin just came out with respect to how to fix the healthcare system so that we don't have these exploding costs, which are responsible for at least half of this $200 trillion fiscal gap, it's really related to huge numbers of old people, baby boomers, getting higher and higher benefits each year because we can't control the level of those benefits. So Rivlin and Ryan have this proposal, but it's exactly the proposal that I wrote about in a book called The Healthcare Fix. I'm not saying they took it from me. I think they figured it out on their own. And I got the proposal from a terrific economist named John Goodman at the National Center for Policy Analysis. And by the way, the Israelis, the Dutch, the Germans, the Swiss, they all have this particular type of system. It's basically a voucher system. It's not necessarily called that, but it's basically everybody gets an individual specific voucher that is bigger for people with pre-existing conditions, and they buy a healthcare policy, and what's covered is set by a government panel, and the government's liability is fixed because the government provides the vouchers and then says, that's it, this is all we can do for you, buy a basic policy, and by the way, insurance companies, here's what you have to cover, and the vouchers are going to be big enough to cover what we say you have to cover. So that's in my book, The Healthcare Fix, but it's just a sense. So there are solutions. I'm trying to get across the idea that there are answers, and the coming generational storm lays these things out. But if you wait, if you wait long enough, this gets back to your question about getting stuck in a bad city state. It's one thing to say that if things that can't go on will end. That's true. But another thing that we should really be saying is that things that go on too long, that things that can't go on may go on too long. And my view is that things have gone on far too long, and we're in a critical point. And unless we really do radical things immediately to get control of the spending, we're really killing the American dream.
So you speak about something you call physical relativity. Can you explain to our listeners really what that is? And you also, you have a very clear equation that you utilize in the book to help explain it. And it's the A equals C plus D plus V minus T. Can you tell our listeners really something about this physical relativity and the effect it has, and also kind of explain the equation as well?
Yeah, well, the idea here is that just as in physics, there's things that aren't well defined. For example, time and distance aren't well defined in physics. Einstein taught us that depending on how you're traveling through space and at what speed, you're going to measure time differently and also distance differently. So there's no absolute time, there's no absolute distance. It's a matter of your frame of reference, your language, in effect, how you describe time and distance. It's not a well-defined physical concept. The same thing is true about the debt and the deficit. How we describe the government's receipts will determine what we report to be the debt and the deficit. And that's what we call the general relativity of fiscal language. So this is a much simpler point than what Einstein, you know, Einstein had to actually use high-powered math and to be a genius. You can be completely untrained in economics to understand this point. And this point is very simple. You're going to, this year are going to be paying, let's say, a couple thousand bucks in FICA taxes and what the government calls FICA taxes for what it calls Social Security benefits in the future. So suppose the government were to change its words and call the contributions you're making for Social Security a borrowing. That the government says, hey, I'm not taxing you this year, I'm borrowing this money from you this year. And suppose that it refers to some of the benefits it's going to give you back in the future as repayment of principal plus interest on that borrowing, less a tax in the future if what it pays you back doesn't correspond exactly to principal plus interest. So you're going to hand over the same amount of money right now. You're going to get exactly the same amount of money in the future. The government's just going to change the words. And by changing the words that it uses to describe what you're giving today and what you're getting back in the future, it will change the reported taxes this year and therefore the reported deficit this year, and therefore the reported debt, because the debt is the change in the deficit, the summation, the deficit is the change in the debt from one year to the next. So if the deficit's bigger, the debt, the stock of debt is bigger. So you can see that it's just a matter of words. What words should I use? If I take $1,000 from you or $2,000 from you this year, I'm the Uncle Sam. Did I borrow it or did I tax you? Well, there's nothing in economic theory that tells us what words to use. We can discuss economic theory, economic equations, our mathematical models of economies with French, German, Swahili. The equations are the same, and they are going to produce the same real effects, but depending on what language we use, we can start reporting any size deficit or surplus we want through time. But the total fiscal gap that the country's facing and the generational burdens, those things are invariant to the choice of labels. So there are things you can measure correctly. If you're driving in L.A., you can actually find a map of L.A. and get to the right place. But if you're driving in L.A. and you're using a map of New York, it's hopeless. And that's what we're basically doing. We're driving in L.A. with a map of New York. We're focused on a $9 trillion official debt when the real number that we should be looking at is the $200 trillion fiscal gap.
Well, that makes perfect sense to my listeners. What you're saying is it's not being accounted for. And one of the things that you talk about, Larry, is this, I'm going to ask this question, is how does this, what you refer to as the general equilibrium effect, shift the potential future challenges that we face to yep. funding this capital deepening? And just for my listeners, that's basically referring around the older population. So there are certain factors here, things like inflation, which can have an effect on this and so on. So can some of this challenge that we're faced with from all generations be affected positively? And what might be some of the things that you would recommend?
Okay. Let me, first of all, I don't want to miss this other question about that equation we had in the book. We were just trying to basically say that fiscal policy is, generationally speaking, a zero-sum game. And that little equation in the book is basically just saying things that anybody would find perfectly sensible and logical, that if the government spends more, it has to be paid for either by current generations or future generations. And so the question is, who's going to pay for what the government spends? And that's the basics of generational accounting. We figure out what the government's likely to be spending into the future, how much the current adults are paying towards those bills, and what bills are going to be left for future generations and kids and future generations to cover, and how big is that burden that's going to be imposed on them. That's what generational accounting is about. Now, the other thing you just raised was the issue of was general equilibrium kind of feedback effects. What does this do to the macroeconomics of the economy, to growth, to wages? Well, that's also something we discuss in the book, and we do it in very simple terms because the book, by the way, is sold about 50,000 copies, so it's not exactly a bestseller, but it's not a bad seller either. So it's a very readable book, I think, and it tries to get across the economics in very simple terms so that you don't need any background in economics really to understand it. But the basic idea is this: if you take from young people and give to old people and they spend it, if you take money, resources that young people were otherwise going to save and invest, and you take it from them and you give it to old people and they consume it, well, the economy doesn't save as much because you're taking from savers and giving to young savers and giving to old spenders. And consequently, there's less saving and less investment. And investment is the addition to our machinery and plants and residential buildings, the tools, in effect, that workers have to work with to produce output. So if there's less capital being accumulated in the economy over time, and the new workers who come to work to find jobs, they're going to find less tools to work with, and therefore they're going to earn less. They'll be less productive, and therefore they will earn less in the marketplace. Their wages will be lower. So we're hitting our kids with a double whammy. We're confronting them with very high taxes, which are going to skyrocket over time unless we get control of the spending, or we're going to have hyperinflation, which is kind of an implicit way to tax people. And we are screwing up the economy. We're leaving them in a situation where their wages are going to be much lower than they would otherwise be and not growing. And we've seen this for the last, you know, you said, are we already there? Well, to a large extent, we are. We've got very high marginal tax rates, very high disincentives to work. We have pretty high average tax rates. We have and we have very little wage growth. You know, the typical worker hasn't really enjoyed, apart from increases in their health benefits, they haven't experienced much in the way of real wage hikes for 30 years. Mm-hmm. So we've had stagnation there, and this does connect to the fact that the national saving rate has gone from about 15% in 1965 to negative 1.5% last year.
Right.
The domestic investment rate has gone from about 15% of national income back in 1965 to only 1.8% last year. So exactly what our theory predicts from this fiscal policy is happening. You're seeing huge increases in the consumption of the elderly relative to the young, associated with a big increase in total consumption of the household sector relative to national income, a big decline in national saving, a big decline in national domestic investment rate. And the reason that we have these big current account deficits, these trade deficits with China, is that we don't save anything. We're saving less than nothing, so therefore we can't invest, and therefore foreign countries are saying, well, there's investment opportunities in the U.S. We'll invest in the U.S. if the Americans aren't going to do it.
Well, do you see at some point, I mean, I know the general public speaks about this, and my listeners can equate. In today's world, what I sense, and this is going to be a pretty commonsensical question, is that there isn't this level of confidence, and there's a higher level of fear about even going back to spending. But is that the issue? I mean, that's only one. And then the other question I have right on the back end of that one that I'd like to have you address for our listeners is, you know, there's always been this statement by the government that we might be able to work our way out of this problem by delaying retirement. Well, we're hearing that now. You know, let's shift instead of 65, let's go to 67, and let's go to 70. The actuarially, if you look at the numbers, and I have a background in this, they're not going to have a very big effect, are they?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. They're doing too little, too late, all the time. And the Greenspan Commission in 83 did far too little. They could have anticipated. Since they didn't solve the whole future problem, they just solved the next 75 years, they could have realized that in 27 years, there would be a bigger problem left for people to face than they actually were facing back in 1983, because they hadn't dealt with things they could have anticipated back in 83. They only tried to solve it for 75 years. So you're absolutely right that, that we're not contemplating policies that are significant enough with respect to spending cuts or tax hikes, and the policies that we are contemplating are all policies that go after the kids. If you think about gradually raising the Social Security retirement age, as the Deficit Commission just proposed, well, who's going to get hurt? Our current retirees going to get hurt, who might be middle class and rich? Some of them, no. It's going to be your kids and my kids. And they're the ones who are going to face much lower benefits. And raising the Social Security retirement age by 3 years, for example, up to age 70, is going to constitute about a 20% benefit cut. Our kids are already going to face, because the thresholds beyond which their Social Security benefits are subject to taxation are not indexed for inflation, they're going to see 85% of their Social Security benefits subject to federal income taxation, no matter how much they earn. Mm-hmm. They're low earners or high earners. That's going to take away about another 25% of the benefits. So we already have in place, with the policy that's being proposed and what's already in place on the taxation side, a prescription for taking away 45% of the benefits of Social Security from the next generation.
Yeah, there's a statement out here that it's real social but real insecure. It's not social.
It's expropriation. It's fiscal child abuse. It's fundamentally fiscal child abuse is what's going on.
But is Social Security, is it even sustainable, the whole concept of Social Security at this
point? You need to force people to save. You need to force people to buy insurance. The government has a role here. It doesn't need to force young people to pay for old people's benefits. We need to take each cohort and force them to take care of themselves so they don't try and free ride on each other. There is a very important role here for Social Security to play, and it has been playing doing some extremely important things and very good things. I'm not bashing Social Security by any means, but it and Medicare and Medicaid, all of which have done marvelous things, have also done marvelous bads,
right?
Huge bads, terrible bads, and those bads are going to overwhelm the country.
Well, Larry, you say that it's far too late to escape the generational storm, but there is still time to kind of get out of its direct path and avoid the full brunt of its impact now. Granted, you wrote this book in 2004. I recognize that's 6 years ago. It has your position changed from the time which you actually have written this book and watched 6 years of economics go by? Obviously, that statement in of itself may have changed. Is that correct?
Yes, we're in much worse shape than we were back then because we've spent 6 years not fixing the problem, letting Medicare and Medicaid benefit levels rise significantly. And when you do that, you're telling the 78 million baby boomers, hey, folks, you all, when you hit retirement, are all going to have higher benefits. And so there's this cost that's associated, it's kind of an exponential cost associated with even waiting a few years to fix things. So we're in much worse shape now than we were in 2004, and part of this is the recession, and we see that we have a financial system that is fundamentally corrupt and needs to be radically fixed, and that's in my book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead. We'll talk together on the air, I'm sure, about that one as well, but we need to do things on a much more urgent basis than we were even thinking about back in 2004. It's that bad.
Oh, most definitely. And I sense your concern and the degree of urgency and so on. And I want to let our listeners know that we're going to be doing an ongoing series with you, Larry. We're going to be speaking about Jimmy Stewart is Dead and another book called Spend Till the End. Where would our listeners go to find out more information? I know you can get this book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the major booksellers, but I'm at your website now, which is www.kotlikoff, K-O-T-I-L.
No, L-I-L-I.
Sorry, K-O-T-L-I-K-O-F-F.net. They can go there, and all the books are at the top, as well as additional information on the side, Jimmy Stewart is Dead. You've got all kinds of references up there and also some YouTube videos and other interviews. So I want to reference them there. Is there any place else you'd like to direct our listeners as far as finding out more information, Larry?
Well, the website, kotlikoff.net, has lots of op-eds I've written and lots of articles. So basically everything I write, I put up there. And but in addition, the book Spend Till the End that we'll be discussing is about personal finance and how people can try and personally adjust to what's coming and at least try and get the best financial kind of response on their own to the situation. So if they go to esplanner.com, which stands for Economic Security Planner, esplanner.com,
mm-hmm.
There's a link on kotlikoff.net to esplanner.com. There's a free version of our software that's my company's website, but we have a free version of our software at esplanner.com/basic, and there's a link at esplanner.com to this free version. And people can use that simple web-based tool to figure out how to raise their living standard on a safe basis. There's lots of choices about that people can make about what job to take, when to take Social Security benefits, whether to use a Roth IRA, whether to repay their Social Security and reapply for higher benefits, a whole bunch of things, whether to refinance this way with points or without, whether to downsize their home. There's lots of issues.
And is all of that at the esplanner.com? It's in the software itself?
It's in the software. We have detailed software programs that people can buy for $149 or $199 that we sell, but also there's a version that's for free at espnr.com/basic. Mm-hmm. It was voted ranked number one by Money Magazine recently. And if you go to espnr.com and click on press, you'll see 100 articles in every top publication and website.
What a great resource. Thank you for letting my listeners know about that. So it's ES Planner, and if you go to his website, you'll see it on the side. It says ES Planner Basic, and then there's ES Planner. Is that an ASP-based kind of software? It's as they download it, you have it for Mac and for PC?
Well, it runs on it's Windows-based software, but it can run on a Mac. And if you can run your Mac in Windows mode, which I do on my Mac, you can run it on a Mac. So I run – everybody in my company is using Macs, and not everybody, but most of us are.
Okay.
And we're running the program off the Mac.
So dual processor. So those Mac users who like me, would maybe want to take a look at this. It's available.
Right. There's also, the book Spindle-Dan, which we'll talk about in detail, I'm sure, but also there's case studies posted at esplanner.com, and it doesn't cost you anything to read the case studies. And I go about a page, and bingo, you can see a quick idea how to save money, how to make money safely. And it's not investment tips. I'm not into telling people how to invest. I'm telling people how to get the best deal from Uncle Sam and how to maximize their own human capital.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, it's been a great time having you on today. I'm sure that for me, I was certainly enlightened by where this is all going, and obviously over the 6 years since this book has been published, there's changes. But I think it gives our listeners at least the foundation that there's a flaw in the accounting, that the generations behind us, meaning I'm speaking for myself because I'm not a millennium, I'm a baby boomer, those generations are going to be footing the bill here, folks. And it's, as he said, $200 trillion. Not the $9 trillion that you mentioned. So it's a huge challenge. There's a lot of variables that can affect it, as Larry has mentioned today. But something for you certainly to at least take a look at, and then as Larry is mentioning here, learn ways to plan your own finances around it. I think that's the least that somebody can do. And so I want to thank you for opening my listeners' eyes to that too, as far as the ES Planner Basic is concerned, and the software, and obviously other ways. But just be educated. Open your eyes to what's going on. Thanks, Larry, for being on the program with us. I appreciate you taking the time, and we'll be doing the next interview with Larry regarding his book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead, and then the third in this series will be Spend Till the End.
So my pleasure. Thank you.